I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of La Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started La Bernardin in 1986 with her brother Gilbert after operating the restaurant with the same name in Paris. When Gilbert died from a heart attack in 1994, Eric Ripert took over as the restaurant's co-owner and chef. Maggie and Eric are co-authors of La Bernardin Cookbook. La Bernardin has been awarded 3 Michelin stars and has held 4 stars from the New York Times since it opened. Welcome.
Thank you.
What are your earliest memories of eating fish?
Oh, from the very beginning, I didn't like meat. So that was easy. When I was very young, 3-4 years old, I was eating in the dining room in our little hotel restaurant in Brittany with my brother, and we were eating fish.
So you lived in Brittany, and your parents operated a small hotel restaurant. How involved were you in the restaurant? What roles did you have?
We were involved very, very early, like peeling potatoes. We were stuffing clams. We were 7 or 8 years old. I was in the dining room with my mother, and my brother was in the kitchen with my father. And then my father had this idea, as he had 2 grown-up kids, to open a disco.
Tell me about the disco. This is now in the 1960s?
Yes, and it was one of the first disco in Brittany. So we were very successful, but we didn't know how to make money. And then later on, my brother was in his early 20s. He was working as in a disco in Paris. And then he really learned how to make money.
What kind of music played in the disco at the time?
The music of the Rolling Stone.
And your grandfather was a fisherman. Do you recall going out with him to catch fish?
Not me. I didn't like too much going on the boat, but my brother really liked doing that. And he preferred to go on the boat with my grandfather than to go to school, to tell you the truth. He was very young when he started to go on the boat with him. And one day there was a tempest that raised very quickly, and they had to tie him up with ropes to prevent him to be thrown away off the boat.
Did you both know from the early days that you wanted to go into business together and open a restaurant together? How did that happen?
Not at all. I wanted to be a stewardess, and my brother wanted to work on boats, but the kind of big boats where they go far away.
Cargo?
Yes, cargo.
Ah. Why did you want to be a stewardess?
Because I wanted to get out of Brittany and travel. That was it. I knew early in my life that I would not stay in Brittany. It was too remote, and I knew that there was a life somewhere else.
Eventually, you and your brother moved to Paris.
Yes.
But before opening the restaurant, you dabbled in different areas for a few years. What are some of the things that you did?
I modeled for a couple of years. Then I was a receptionist in an hotel. Then I was hostess in a restaurant. And every year we would come back to Brittany to help our parents.
How did you both then make the decision to open the restaurant?
Because there was nothing else that we knew. We didn't know that it was going to be so difficult, because the small training that we had in that small hotel restaurant was not enough to make a success in Paris. So we opened that restaurant in Paris in 72 with the help of everyone, friends, family, loan at the bank. It was a disaster. We didn't know how to run the restaurant to make money. We were having fun being outside every night after when the restaurant was closed. And several times we thought that we would had to file for bankruptcy.
Your restaurant was almost taken away at one point.
That's right.
What is the story behind that?
One day I went for whatever reason to the market with my brother. And we came back with the small car full of fish, and we saw a notice on the window, for sale. This is our restaurant, this is us. It said, so I called the number and a man came. He said, all right, young lady, I'm going to help you. Can we sit somewhere? I said, yes, please come to my apartment. It's above the restaurant. He said, I'm going to help you. We can just take a lean on your furniture. What do you have? Here, I have one table, which is my desk, and two chairs. And I have my bedroom. I have my bed, and that's it. He said, that's the only thing I cannot take. So it's to show you how difficult it has been.
But despite this difficulty initially, you were actually opening a restaurant at an auspicious moment. Your brother, who was a chef with no formal training, benefited from a new experimentation going on in the French culinary community at the time. What impact do you think that had on your brother's cooking?
It was the beginning of the nouvelle cuisine. He tried to have some imagination. All the chefs were trying new way to get out of that heavy French cooking. So it was, in a way, the right time. He became friendly with all the chefs of his generation, went to have dinner with them, started to travel with them. They were always invited everywhere in France, whether it's to taste the truffles that were coming out or to taste wine. That's when everything started to come in his mind, I suppose.
And the first restaurant was called Le Bernardin.
It was called Le Bernardin, yes.
What does that mean?
It is a song that our father was singing to us called Les Moines de Saint Bernardin. Those monks were well known for the good life. They liked to eat and to drink. And that first location was on the left bank, not far from the restaurant that we were going to open. So we named the restaurant after those monks.
So you're talking about monks in a monastery? There's a monastery,
yes,
close to you? And monks obviously are known for their asceticism.
Yes, not those one.
I see. And so your father would sing this song to,
yes,
you growing up?
Yes. It's a well-known song.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started Le Bernardin in 1986 with her brother, Gilbert.
You operated the Paris restaurant from 1972 to 1987 in two locations.
Yes.
And the impetus for your closing the restaurant in Paris was that you opened up a New York restaurant.
Exactly.
In 1986.
Yes.
Why did you decide to move to New York?
It's very difficult to say because I didn't know New York. It's out of the blue. I was pushed by I don't know what or who, but it was very strong. And I started in the 1980 already to think about New York. I came once with my brother and we stayed 2 weeks. And my brother said, there is nothing here. There is no good vegetable. There is no herb. There is nothing. We cannot open a restaurant. And I told him, you are a coward. But he said, no way, we are not ready, and this town is not ready. We cannot do it. So a few years later, I told him, I don't want to stay here all my life. You will be 50 years old with a big belly behind your stove, and I will be with white hair at the entrance. I told him, I don't want a family, I'm not interested. I just want to run another business.
So you're eager to open a restaurant in New York. Your brother, not so much. What next? You tried a few times to start a restaurant, but investors repeatedly fell through.
It took me several times. One time I thought that I had everything. I had 10 different investment partner friends. And at the last minute, there was always one who would say no. And one year, I came back and I had almost a nervous breakdown because a deal didn't go through.
And then finally, a partnership randomly came together with essentially a stranger in New York City. You met Mr. Holloway, who was the head of Equitable.
Yes, he was the chairman of Equitable.
And Equitable is the real estate company that owns the building that you've been in.
Yes.
How did you meet him?
We met him through a friend of mine whose brother was a very good friend of Ben Holloway. And he knew that he was finishing that huge building on the west side, which was not at that time a very well-known location.
155 West 51st Street.
So we went to his house. We opened a bottle of Dom Pérignon. We shook hands, said, that's it, we have a deal. Do you have an architect? Yes, we do. Tell your architect to get in touch with the architect of the building tomorrow. Do you have a lawyer? Yes, we do. Tell your lawyer to get in touch with the lawyer of the building and let's work on him. I said, but we don't have a deal. He said, we'll work on that. So they started to build the restaurant. We signed the deal 6 months later. He had so much trust and confidence with us that he knew that we were going to do it.
What was the restaurant landscape at the time in that neighborhood in Midtown?
It was not a good neighborhood. At night, we had some of our employees who were mugged. Nobody thought that it could be a right location, and we thought that it was going to be a right location because we were next to Rockefeller Center and next to Broadway.
But it was kind of accidental that you launched in this neighborhood.
Yes, that's right, because we had a very good deal.
How did you get financing from the beginning? Even you had Equitable as your landlord.
Yes.
But did they provide the capital to get the restaurant off the ground?
It was a turnkey operation.
A turnkey operation?
Yes, meaning that they would do all the work and then buy table, chairs, china, glassware, everything.
Lucky you.
Yes.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin. We'll hear more from Maggie coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and Le Bernardin received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. She partnered with celebrity chef Eric Rappaire after Gilbert died in 1994. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011. Now, your brother came to New York kicking and screaming because it
Yes.
was your wish. Did you ever think that maybe you and your brother should part ways because you wanted to be in New York and he wanted to be in Paris?
Well, no, we were very, very close and that was enough.
Your brother was protesting that there are no good herbs and no good vegetables. Where did he find, or where did you both find, the produce and the fish for your restaurant in Midtown?
The good thing was that New York is on the water, so Gilbert figured out that some fish were going to come to New York. He just had to find where to find them. He went to the Fulton Fish Market. Was the first restaurateur ever going to the fish market. That was very interesting because he made the fish market discovered by the journalist who came with him, and then the TV went with him to the fish market, and suddenly the fish market has been known, and then the fishmonger was happy to be on TV, so we were treated very well with them.
So your brother brought publicity to Fulton Fish Market
Yes.
because journalists and the TV crew would follow your brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your brother did not speak English very well.
Gilbert didn't speak English. So his way to connect with them was just pointing out the fish and just pointing out the fish that they wanted to sell, which is no good. He would say, no, no good. And that was it. And after a while, they understood that he really knew how to choose the fish.
So your brother was an expert in fish thanks to his family upbringing.
Yes, thanks to my grandfather, who was the fisherman.
And when you were first launching the restaurant in 1986, what were some of the challenges that you faced?
We could not find waiters. So we took our maitre d' from Paris with us, and the dining room became a school for 1 month. And we had at that time the biggest kitchen in New York. We had the first page of the New York Times with a picture of the kitchen. And we were serving dinner every night in the kitchen to train the waiters. And then we started to train waiters in the dining room, like having just 5 or 6 tables and increasing every day. And we had no publicity, no public relation to help us, just people would see that there was light and that they heard that Le Bernardin was opening, and they would knock at the door and say, when are you going to be open? We said, we don't know, when we will be ready. And one night, Gilbert said, okay, we'll be ready soon. Maggie, you get 50 people in the dining room and nothing else for 1 month.
Do you remember what was on the menu the first night when you opened?
We had raw fish on the menu. Nobody in New York had eaten raw fish except in a few sushi places. So I would take the order at the table with the maitre d' and convince people to try to take the raw fish. And I would say, please, try it. And if you don't like it, we'll give you something else. There was a lot of tuna in New York. And the tuna, when it's too cooked, it's not good at all. So I said to my brother, listen, why don't we serve it raw? So we had carpaccio of tuna. We had some raw fish marinated that we serve on a green salad. We had sea urchin, which was not very popular. So we had a sea urchin in a butter of sea urchin. We had oyster, of course. We had oyster with truffle, which was very unusual as well. We had fish soup. We had skate.
Squid.
Yes. We had served monkfish, which was not very well known either, that we would serve with leeks.
All that on the first night?
Oh, yes. When we were ready, we were ready. And every week, I would increase a little bit.
Now, your responsibilities were always split between your being in the front of the house and his always being the chef. Did you ever try to cook yourself?
No, I never tried because I never had the opportunity. That was not the tradition in the 50s and 60s to have women in the dining room. It was women in the front and men in the kitchen.
You mentioned that your brother had no traditional training and
That's
that
right.
He was really more of an artist and he used his imagination. How did that help him in the kitchen, do you think, versus having a formal training?
Because our food was different, was very light. There was some broth, then emulsion.
Emulsion.
Yes. Spices, herbs. His menu was simple, but that's what was important because then really people started to appreciate the fish. And the fish was so fresh that it was really good.
You mentioned green salad, that you served fish on top
with
of green salad.
Yes. Oh, that was a big deal.
What was Gilbert's relationship with salad?
Oh, a nightmare. Because we had customer coming and asking for a green salad. And he says, no, we are not serving green salad. I said, why not? Because you are in the restaurant. It's a fish restaurant, and I don't go to the fish market every night to serve a green salad. That was it. We would not serve green salad.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of La Bernardine, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and La Bernardine received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011. Incidentally, when exactly did you open the restaurant to the public?
The restaurant was ready by November 1985. We knew that it was not the right time to open in the middle of the season, but we opened in January, which had always been successful for us. All the restaurants that we opened in January.
What were some of the mistakes you made in the early days of the restaurant?
I don't think we made mistakes. We were strong enough not to open the restaurant and to accept a lot of customers the first 2 months. So when Gail Green, who was the first person who reviewed the restaurant, came, the restaurant was ready. Her friends was telling her, you must go to the restaurant, it's really good. She said, I promised them not to go before they tell me that they are ready. So finally she came, and Brian Miller came right away.
Brian Miller of the New York Times.
Yes.
Which gave you 4 stars.
Which was a big deal for him because it was at the beginning of him being at the New York Times, and it was the first 4 star that he gave. In his first article that he did, he said, I wish that we can take their passport so that they don't go back to France. And suddenly we were overwhelmed with the phones. We couldn't answer the phones. We had 5 person on the reservation, and it was not enough. We had to buy a sophisticated answering machine to take over. Nobody could reach us. It was very special. It was special days.
When you got your 4 stars from the New York Times,
yes.
Do you remember that moment when you found out?
Yes, we found out because by coincidence, we had that night friends coming from France, and I said, you arrive right on time. Tonight we are going to see what we are going to get with the New York Times. The manager came at that moment with plenty of New York Times in his hands and threw away the newspaper in the restaurant.
The manager threw the newspaper in the air.
Absolutely. And in the private room, we had a reservation. It was 15 people. And they were all people from the New York Times. They all came down the stairs, and everybody was applauding.
Oh.
And everyone in the restaurant started to understand. So everyone started to applaud, and it was really a wonderful moment. And then we went outside to celebrate. When we came back, we called our father and explained him. And he said, so, you didn't go to the Fulton Fish Market this morning, my son?
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of La Bernardine, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Your brother, Gilbert, passed away in 1994 from a heart attack?
From a heart attack, yes.
Was it sudden? Was it?
Yes, it was sudden, but not really. A year before, he had a kind of small attack. At night, he woke up and his girlfriend, she rushed him to the hospital. And 3 days later, he asked the maître d' and Eric and the manager to come to the hospital with the mail, and in front of them he took all the tube that he had in his hand. He said, I am fine, and don't say anything to my sister or you will be fired.
So he took out all the tubes, all the needles and tubes from the hospital?
Yes. If I had known, I would have battled and fight with him so that to do the test. He was supposed to do tests that he never did.
So your brother kept his heart attack a secret so you wouldn't worry and force him to undergo a series of tests.
Yes.
Eric Repair, your now chef and co-owner,
yes.
Came on board, took over in 1994 when your brother passed away. Eric had been working in the kitchen with Gilbert.
With Gilbert, yes.
What was that relationship like?
Gilbert was very friendly with Jean-Louis Paladin, a very well-known chef who was running a restaurant in the Watergate Hotel in Washington. He's the first French chef who came to the United States. And Gilbert asked him if he had someone that he could recommend because he knew that could not go further than what he has done, that he really need new blood. And Jean-Louis Paladin introduced him to my brother. And Eric, it took like a few months before Eric accepted it. They were meeting every Saturday at breakfast and talked about everything. They became friends before they became the chef of the restaurant.
Now, Eric's style of cooking is very different from your brother's. Gilbert was more ad hoc and there was no formal education, whereas Eric is well-schooled.
Oh, yes. Eric has the best training.
How is that manifested in the menu? How is the menu different as a result of now having Eric on board versus Gilbert?
When Gilbert died, I said to Eric, we have to stop. Don't do it at all, anything that Gilbert was doing, except the raw fish. We'll keep that, and everything has to be new.
How come?
Because I wanted to really to show that I should no longer think of my brother, and that Eric was a chef, and that he was talented, and that I wanted to show his talent.
I could see it going the other way. I could see some owners saying, I want you to continue in my brother's tradition. So it was probably freeing for Eric to have that
yes.
license from you.
Yes, definitely.
When the reviewers came to review the restaurant under Eric's auspices,
yes.
what were the results?
It was Ruth Reichel in 1995.
And?
4 stars.
4 stars.
Yes.
New York Times. Are you tearing up because this is emotional for you?
Absolutely. It's 40 years of my life. But I have Eric and I. We are very close. We are like friends. I consider him like more than a business partner. He's my family. He's like my brother in a sense.
And Eric is really the public face of the restaurant to some degree. The star of a TV series called Avec Eric,
yes.
and a judge on Top Chef. How do you feel about his taking on that role with the restaurant, whereas you're more not behind the scenes because you're in from the front of the restaurant, but you certainly don't have your own TV series and you're not the one that has as much fame as he.
It's wonderful. I can go away whenever I want. And nobody is asking for me. Everybody is asking for Eric. It doesn't make a difference if I am there or not because I have a computer everywhere I go. I do the administration work in the restaurant. So every day I speak with everyone and I look at the numbers and that's fine.
Now, how has your job changed from the inception, from 1986 when you opened to now? What does your job entail?
In 1986, I was in the front. I was at the podium greeting people and then going through one table to the other, seeing if everything was fine. Mm-hmm. And then I would be in the restaurant from 6 o'clock to midnight, saying goodbye to the last customer. Plus the work in the office, it was very long days.
How has your clientele's taste changed from the beginning of the restaurant's opening till now?
They are very sophisticated now, yes. I don't remember, but what I can tell you is in one night we could have 15 tables taking tasting menus with wine pairing. So it means that the clientele is really sophisticated. They know about food.
There are so many restaurateurs expanding and having 2, 3, 5, 10 restaurants, whether they're all in New York or in other states. How come you're sticking with La Bernardine only.
This is our choice. We like to be unique. When the customer comes, we want that experience to be very special. We always manage to be in the restaurant, either Eric or me, so that the customer can have that special experience. If they want to meet with us, we are there.
What is your diet like? What did you eat for breakfast this morning?
I eat cornflakes with skim milk, grapefruit that the restaurant prepare for me, and Greek yogurt. And lunch, it's green salad with vegetables and fruits.
How often are you eating in the restaurant?
Every day, lunch and dinner. And dinner, I pick up everything from the menu. I taste everything. And I sit down in the dining room, and I want to be served like a customer. That's where I see the details.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of La Bernardine. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.
Aller à matine, vider quelques flacons, voilà ce qui est bon et bon, bon, bon.
Et voilà la vie, la vie, la vie, la vie, chérie, ah, ah. Et voilà la vie que tous les mois me font. Et voilà la vie, la vie, la vie, la vie, chérie, ah, ah. Et voilà la vie que tous les mois me font.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability, and there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now, rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and then to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
See, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there was something like 18,000 university graduates in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had 4 university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had 4 university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother had, was a really great teacher, and so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension, basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after 4 kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents, and in the afternoons I'd go and meet with her and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today that school is one of the top performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly, and it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom, and then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily. I didn't know where my meals were going to come from.
where I would get money to buy clothes from, and, you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch, you know, so I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the Academy off the ground or to make the idea of the Academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. You know, one was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for the campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. Hmm. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and you know, we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle, and she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in a first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her, and then at the end she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money, and, you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing, and, you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were sort of the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was she lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18, running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back, a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.